countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is Saturday once more, the 23rd of November in the glorious future year of 2024. And how do we begin our show? Answer is mail call, ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a, mail call. Just as a reminder, you're always welcome to send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Man and Atom, Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. And what do we have for you today? Here's a postcard from MNW, SDF's own DJ Marcus, who has this time slot Monday through Friday. And what is it a postcard of? Well, it appears to be someone working on a step-by-step type telephone exchange. And the caption says, "Switchman at work on a Strouger switch." Where is it from? It is from the Connections Museum, the Telecommunications Museum in Seattle. Telecomhistory.org, it says at the bottom. And this was postmarked from Seattle on November the 13th. I am guessing that DJ Marcus was in Seattle for a conference, since, of course, he normally hangs out in Austin, Texas. But what does he have to say? "Hello! Saw Strouger and crossbar switches live and in action. Tried a THC-infused soda. It was quite strong in an intoxicating effect and lemon flavor. The Connections Museum was incredible. They have a lot of old ham gear and a Windows 95 PC. Wish you all the best. DJ Marcus." Now, thank you, DJ Marcus, for the postcard. Always appreciated. Now, a very funny little bit of mail here. The other day, a piece of mail came to my house that was addressed to the previous residents, and considering I moved into this house 20 years ago, in fact, like 6 months more than 20 years ago, I sent them back a letter saying, "I'm sorry, those folks don't live here no more." Anyway. And so I'm going to read you what I got back, because the kind person, anyway, I mailed it back, and the person sent me a note. And on the outside of the envelope it says, "My husband and I love the vintage stamps," because, of course, as with other mail I sent out, I slathered it with old space stamps. "Dear C.D. November 18th, Dear C.D. Carson, I honestly thought I would never see that card again. I have been asking my aunt for a week if she got my card, and she said no. I addressed it wrong. Thank you for the time you took to return it to me. P.S. The card contains some cash, so thank you so much." Well, there you go. Somebody looked at the wrong page in their address book and mailed a card to the wrong address. Or mailed a piece of mail to the wrong address. I sent it back, and they sent me back a little note thanking me. Isn't that kind of them? So that's the good news. And remember, you are always welcome to send me mail. I prefer receiving mail that's actually addressed to me, and is intended for me, but as you can see, I can even deal with mail that isn't addressed to or intended for me. What else is there to say? Well, in the field of bad news, world news that I had hoped never to hear, It was reported early this week that Russia had fired an intercontinental ballistic missile against Ukraine. Now, this was honestly a bit of a puzzler. First, what? And second, why? So, the reports were that the missile had been fired from the region of Astrakhan, 700 kilometers or so from Dnipropetrovsk, where it fell. And that is a very, very short range for an intercontinental ballistic missile. It's not physically impossible, but suffice to say that the boost phase of an ICBM launch is frequently 200 to 500 kilometers long. Right, that's how far it's still burning at that distance. And so the flight profile to fire an ICBM 700 kilometers doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Further reports suggest that this was, in fact, an intermediate-range ballistic missile, which had been labeled as an ICBM to evade the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Russia has since denounced the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, and so they were test-firing this thing in its IRBM mode rather than its short-range ICBM mode, I guess you'd say. Because every you can have you have your choice of flight profiles, which allows somewhat different targeting. Anyhow, but bad show all around. But it makes you wonder why they did this. I mean, presumably it's meant to be a show of strength, showing off, oh, look how big and bad we are. We've got these ballistic missiles. Thing is, you fire a ballistic missile so basically, it's suspected this is essentially a test firing meant to show off their capability. But they just pointed it at a place in Ukraine, and of course when it fell, it did considerable damage. There's no warhead, of course, but that doesn't really matter when something is coming in at 3 to 5 kilometers per second. The V-2, right, of the Second World War, had a 1,000-kilogram warhead of ametol, which is a high explosive with a considerably better yield than standard TNT, and it was chosen because it's resistant to high temperatures. It doesn't blow up. Or cook off at high temperatures. Anyway, but the 1,000-kilogram warhead, the kinetic energy of the impacting missile was roughly equivalent to the yield of the warhead. And this is one of the reasons why nobody bothers with ballistic missiles with conventional, that is to say, non-nuclear warheads, because they're very expensive. You're talking about some millions of dollars per shot. So yeah, IRBM, essentially an IRBM test, except that the impact area chosen for the test, instead of being out in the middle of a test range somewhere, was in a city. Frankly, this is a bizarre thing to do. And in combination with the whole business of bringing in North Korean soldiers, it certainly makes me ask the question of whether Vladimir Putin feels he is losing his grip on political control of Russia. I mean, I'm not going to speculate on whether he's losing his grip in other ways. The guy started a war. He can't be right in the head. But so yeah, intermediate-range ballistic missile test targeted at a populated area because, as far as one can envision, it's a case of, well, we've got to test fire this thing to make sure it works. Well, we're trying to kill these people over here anyway. What's one more thing we drop on them? Suffice to say, I don't approve of this attitude. I believe that all intercontinental and intermediate-range ballistic missiles should be repurposed as space launch vehicles and expended. Call this the Steppenwolf program. Fire all of your guns at once and explode into space. That wasn't even a particularly good rendition of that song. course, that does remind me of, it might have been Richard Feynman, his description of the Project Orion, which was, of course, to use nuclear explosives to propel enormous spaceships to the outer fringes of the solar system. He referred to it as unilateral disarmament in 6 round trips to Saturn. And, honestly, sending several hundred people to Saturn and bringing them back, you know, for several hundred people to Saturn to stay there for a year or more, bringing them back, is a far better thing. Right? If you had to choose between menacing the world with destruction for 70 years or sending several hundred people to Saturn for a year or more and bringing them back, I think it's obvious which one of these speaks more highly for your culture, for your civilization, right? Which one of those is more valuable to the human race? Which one of those will have people talking about you favorably for generations to come? So, in a little local news here, I have taken advantage of a sale and ordered some more stickers. As you may remember, I ordered some new stickers, Man and Atom stickers, the three designs, the standard designs I use, the Atomic Fist logo with the slogan Atomic Power to the People, the Atomic Flower logo with the slogan Split Atoms, Not Wood, and the Smiling Atom logo with a slogan No Blood for Oil, Atoms for Peace. I ordered from a new supplier, not the people I've been using before. Why? Well, because the new supplier does crackback, that it's just easier to peel the stickers off, right, when the backing is split down the middle. Unfortunately, when I uploaded my art files, they shrank them. And as a result, the stickers that I got didn't come out looking very nice. And what I'm thinking I'm going to do is actually take the ones that were worst affected, which are the fist stickers. And I'm actually going to get myself a suitably sized lever punch, like scrapbookers use. I already have one that's a square, that's about 40 millimeters. Anyway, I'm going to get a suitably sized circle one, and I'm just going to punch them down into smaller size stickers, since they don't need to be peeled from the edge, so the crack, because of the crackback, and so I can punch them down into smaller size stickers, about 50 millimeter stickers. They're supposed to be like 65 or so. Anyway, but so there's my that's what I'm planning on doing with those stickers that were disappointing. The design is shrunk down on the middle of the sticker. Well, I'm just going to punch the middle of the sticker out and pretend they were meant to be small stickers to begin with. Anyway, but the same company was having a sale. They sent me a coupon for 25% off, so I piddled around with the artwork a little, resubmitted it, and I'm going to try and make sure this time that they actually print what I want them to print. Anyway, and so hopefully those will be here within a week or 10 days. And I will, of course, mail them out to my Patreon supporters. Speaking of which, I want to thank M.H. Cat, who supported me on Patreon for a while and then dropped off and has now come back. So thank you, M.H. Cat. But yeah, I gotta actually get out one of my templates and figure out what size of circle cutter I need. But once I've done that, that should be pretty straightforward. Getting a square one of the size I wanted turned out to be an ordeal simply because I wanted a square with a particular size, and I bought one that was way too small because the dimension they quoted was the diagonal. X1 in comm says he'd like a... he, she, it would like a sticker that says, "War is a euphemism." That's a pretty good slogan. Yeah, war. It's a pretty word for a whole bunch of really horrible things. And Tobe says, "We're better off if they don't come back," referring, of course, as I was mentioning, you know, the social value of billionaires is They'll spend a lot of money to get themselves killed in embarrassing ways, which tells you what not to do in the future. Anyway, but last time I promised to explain the gold standard, and I never actually got there. So I'm going to pick up that story now, all right? What is there to know about the gold standard? Well, the main thing to know is that it's not all one thing. So I was telling you how in medieval Europe, the money which circulated was basically silver. That there was some gold. The gold was used in large transactions, for example, in long-distance trade. But in general, it had no fixed value. The value of the gold fluctuated. So gold coins didn't have a stable relation with silver coins. And that's even assuming the silver coins had a stable relation with each other, which is not always true, because you had princes and bishops and dukes and so forth all making their own coins, and if one of them found that his coins, for example, circulated pretty well in the next guy's territory, he might start reducing the silver content of his coins a little bit in order to try and get a commercial advantage over his neighbor. And there are various other things which cause similar effects. You know, the whole business of taxation by seigniorage, in other words, every so often, you know, you have to bring, you know, if you're bringing money into a country, you've got to bring it all to the mint. The mint melts it down, they assay it, they make coins out of it, and you get 90% of those coins back. So, what else is there to say about this? Well, okay, so in the 15th century, trade was on an upswing. Europe was moving towards a monetary economy from a feudal service-based economy. And in the middle of the 15th century, the big silver deposits are opened up in Central Europe, in particular the Ore Mountains, or Erzgebirge, of Bohemia. In other words, the mountains sort of that bound the what's now Germany and the Czech Republic, and sort of into the Tyrolean Alps, turn out to have these huge deposits of silver ore. 450, 500 years later, we also found out they had big deposits of uranium ore, which became important at that time. But in the 1450s and thereafter, you suddenly have a lot more silver available than was available in the past. And with trade now moving much more rapidly than in the past, the Counts of Schlick in Bohemia have a mine in a place called Joachimsthal, the Valley of St. Joachim. And they start making these enormous coins known as Goldguldeners, 30 or 35 grams of high-quality silver, 90% or more silver by weight. So they're huge, and they turn out to be just what people want at that time, and they're imitated all over the continent. And they're referred to very broadly as Joachimsthalers, which gets abbreviated to taler, dollar, dalder, or in Russian, Yefimok. Similar coins are made in France and Spain and Italy, and they're frequently known as, and Portugal, they're frequently known as escudos, scudi, ecu, which means shield. But all of these were meant to be of the same value, roughly, as a little gold florin from North Italy, which had been a very common trade coin. Of course, again, the relative value of gold and silver fluctuates. Now, another 50 years passes, you have the discovery of the New World, you have Ferdinand and Isabella sending their conquistadores overseas because they've just finished the reconquest of Spain and they don't know what they're going to do with all of these people who, for the past 500 years, have lived entirely by fighting and have no idea of any other way to live, and suddenly they have a place where they can send them and keep them out of trouble, essentially. And, of course, they go and conquer Mexico and Peru and send back enormous volumes of gold and silver, which don't benefit Spain at all, because Spain has very little internal economy. And it doesn't help that around 1500, Ferdinand, the paranoid, gets the bizarre idea that all of the Jews and Muslims in Spain, who are most of the middle class in Spain, such as it is, are involved in a single vast conspiracy to murder him, and he expels them all from the kingdom. Large numbers of them were welcomed in the papal state, actually, by the Pope at the time, who was a Spaniard himself, and who famously said, "Ferdinand has beggared his own kingdom to enrich my own." But that still doesn't tell you much about the gold standard, does it? Well, the other thing we have to remind you of is that coinage at the time, being made of precious metals, it was very easy to scrape, and being made in a rather crude fashion, it was very easy to scrape or sweat the coins to try and get a little of the precious metal off of them. For example, you take a bag, big cloth bag, full of silver coins, and you just shake that bag. You shake it hard for a while. Then you take the coins out, and they still look okay. They're still about the right size and weight. They'll still pass in commerce. But you then take that bag and you burn it in a furnace, and you get a little pill of silver from all the silver dust that was scraped off by shaking and then caught by the weave of the bag. That's what's known as sweating the coinage. And it was a capital crime in most parts of Europe, but it didn't stop people from doing it because it was hard to detect. Similarly, people would take the coins of the time and they'd scrape them with a blade or a stone, shave just a little bit of silver off the edge. And you want to make sure that you're not doing it enough to be noticed. But the result was that many of the coins in circulation, silver coins, weighed much less than their intended weight. Particularly the ones that got paid into the kings and princes and so on in the form of taxes. Because, of course, a king had to take his own coins. About 1690, and this is what caused Isaac Newton to be named Master of the Royal Mint in Britain. About 1690, they went around and determined that the coins being paid into the exchequer were frequently no more than 2/3 of their legal weight, which is a bit of a problem. The crown is losing an immense amount of revenue because, of course, they've got to melt these coins down and pay out money of full weight. And, of course, you have other people who are taking mixed coins and keeping the heavy ones and melting them down and passing the light ones back out into circulation, all of that. So the monetary system is in a certain degree of chaos. Chaos really describes the European monetary system down to a fairly recent date, as you can confirm by looking at all kinds of old publications about the subject. Snelling's View of the Coinage of Europe, for example. Anyway, so, again, the money in circulation is basically silver, and gold is used for some transactions. And beginning about 1500, credit is used increasingly in transactions. And these two phenomena interact with each other in unexpected ways. So Isaac Newton becomes Master of the Royal Mint in Britain and calls in all the old coins to be melted down and turned into good quality new coins made by machine processes so that they're struck very well and are more difficult to sweat and clip and so on, that it shows up really easily. They've got textured edges in some cases. Anyway. But at the same time, he makes a recommendation, which turns out to be epical, in that he suggests an alteration in the value of a gold coin known as a guinea. Now, when the guinea was first produced, it was meant to be worth £1 sterling, or 20 shillings, but it never circulated for that, because the value of the gold in it was a tad bit more than that at the then prevailing market price. So what Newton had the idea of doing was to increase the value at which the gold guinea was valued. He suggested increasing it to 20 shillings and sixpence. This was so awkward that it was increased instead to 21 shillings. In that case, then, the gold guinea was actually worth less at market prices of gold and silver than 21 silver shillings, which meant that it was but it was legally allowed to be used in all payments, which meant, of course, that nobody would pay in silver when they could pay in gold. There were coins as small as 1/3 guinea, or 7 shillings, minted, to allow relatively small payments to be made in gold. At the same time, of course, this had the effect that nobody was going to bring silver into the mint to be made into coins. So there was a terrible shortage of silver coinage in Britain, which was the coinage that everyone actually used. This wasn't resolved for a good 100 years, until the end of the Napoleonic Wars, when, in Britain, the old coinage was completely withdrawn and a new coinage produced. That new coinage was based on a gold coin called the sovereign, which was 20 parts in 21 at the weight of a guinea, and so exactly £1 sterling by the same standard established by Isaac Newton. Then they made the silver coins lighter so that they would circulate and not be withdrawn and melted. And then, in order to make all that work, they instituted a rule that only the government could bring silver to the mint. Basically, what would happen is, in order to fulfill the demand for silver coinage, the Bank of England would buy silver bullion in the marketplace for gold and bring it to the mint, and it would be then coined into these new lighter weight silver coins, 62 shillings to the pound weight rather than 60. No, sorry, the old standard was 62 shillings to the troy pound weight. The new standard was 66 shillings to the troy pound weight. And even your decimal 5p pieces, if you stack up the old ones, not the new small ones, but the old big ones, if you stack up 66 of the old copper nickel 5p pieces, if they're brand new, good condition, and I have plenty of those in that condition, you will find that they weigh 1 troy pound. Anyhow, but the way that they made this work was that nobody other than the Bank of England could bring silver to the mint to be coined. Because if anybody could bring silver to the mint to be coined, of course, they would, and then you'd be flooded with silver coins, which were the lower value, and then that would drive the gold out of circulation again. So the gold standard is the situation where gold is the measure of the value of money. And the kind of gold standard that existed in England, in Britain, at that time, then, was one in which gold coins freely circulated. Gold was the principal money. It was used in commercial transactions. For convenience, people also used paper notes of the Bank of England and private bankers, which, when you brought them back to the bank, would be rechanged immediately for gold. And then, of course, most of the actual day-to-day transactions of the ordinary person were still done in silver, from tiny little silver 3p pieces all the way up to the big 30-gram crown. But the value of the silver money was not actually set by the amount of silver in it. It was set by the amount of gold that you could exchange it for. And the idea was that the value of the silver would be like 90% or so of the value of the gold you could exchange it for. But it wasn't 100%. Because it was difficult to keep coins that would be 100% of their face value in circulation. You see how complex this gets, because you also have bank notes in circulation, and if too many people brought their bank notes to the banks to be rechanged into gold all at once, why, the bank would run short of gold. In fact, this happened during the wars of the French Revolution, that owing to the worries about the international situation, people began bringing their banknotes into the Bank of England to be rechanged for gold, and beginning in 1798, the bank was unable to pay in gold. And so the British government has issued an order in council allowing the bank to simply not pay. And that situation continued for nearly 20 years, known as the bank restriction. So you see, the gold standard as such was actually much more unstable than you might think. Anyway, there's more to this story, and I may tell you more about it later. But otherwise, if you like these broadcasts, you can send me gold, or you can send me electronic forms of money, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, patreon.com/man_and_Adam. More than that, send those cards and letters to post... 5.